welcome to From the World Up. I'm Marcia Witch, or Holly March. Today we're going to be talking about villages, specifically on the medieval European model, but I'm going to touch on other things as well, obviously. First up, I want to start out with explaining why in games like Zelda and Skyrim, killing a chicken is such a big deal. For a medieval peasant, they wouldn't eat the chickens, they would eat the eggs, and eggs were a currency. You would use them to barter, you know, as in Beauty and the Beast with all, I need 6 eggs! Apologise for my singing. Eggs were a currency, they were the main source of food, the main source of protein, and chickens were massively important within that context. So yeah, that is why they go absolutely apeshit when you try and kill a chicken. So I'm going to start with some basics. I learned this very young, so it's kind of one of those informations that you learn when you're younger and then you forget. So very basically, I'm going to talk about the different types of settlement on a very small scale. So the first type is linear settlements. This is where there's already a road or a river and the village kind of springs up along it. So you might start out with a church or an inn at the side of the road where it's easy for people to get to. And then people sort of like, you know, build a house to go next to the inn and then go build something else. And it slowly comes up, but it comes in a very long line along each side of the riverbank or along each side of the river. The next type is nucleated. This is where they are all around one point. So if there's a fortified position, so a castle or a fort, and then the settlement is very focused around that single point. It's the same with abbeys when they were formed in the middle of nowhere, and then a village would of lay people and people catering to pilgrims would then spring up around it. The next type is dispersed. So this is when it's technically a village, but there's lots of houses, but they're just all sort of scattered, but they kind of call each other a village mainly for the sake of like taxation purposes. So an area is called, this area is now going to be called Kinlet, for example. They're all lumped out, but there's no real pattern to them. If they are in a sort of with a central focus, like in a ring, still spread out, but like all circling around a specific place, then it's called radial. So those are like the four main kinds of village, and then obviously they grow and grow and grow and become towns, become cities, etc. As with all naming, whether it be people or things, you want to be consistent. But there are various different reasons why a village or a settlement gets its name. The most common one, certainly in Britain, is after a landmark, and you can combine different landmarks to create a longer name and so that you don't have lots and lots of villages called village. The most obvious and obvious one to give an example of is Llanfairpwllgwyngyllgogerochwyndrobllantysiliochgogogoch. I always mess up the Llwyndrobllantysiliwch mix over. I can't do that many L's, not even I. It's a Welsh village in Anglesey, and it was the name was lengthened in the 1860s as a tourism thing. But the name translates as Parish of St. Mary in Hollow of the White Hazel near the Rapid Whirlpool and the Parish of St. Cecilio with a Red Cave. Yeah, you can do that. I mean, I wouldn't advise doing it all the time because very few places have that kind of thing. Even longer Welsh names tend to get shortened down to, you know, Llanarmon DC or Llanfairpwllgwyngyll, which is really what anybody refers to that village as. You get examples when you have layers of culture. So in Britain, where, you know, we have the Romans invading and the Saxons invading and the Vikings and the Normans all in one go, you get things like, you get the River Avon. Well, Avon is the old Celtic word for river, but, you know, people didn't know that, so they rename it. There's a village somewhere in Staffordshire which is called Hill 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 in three different languages. So if you want to play that kind of layering of having things renamed, it's a really good way of, if you have someone complain about it, it's a really good way of showing the insidious way that language changes after a place has been conquered. Speaking of conquerors, if you look into the US naming traditions, they are freaking bizarre. You get, especially in the old frontier towns, tend to be very strange. Often explorers and conquerors rename villages to remove the connection of old the people that lived there before. and to stop it relating to the past and to constantly being a source of pride in what came before. They call things after themselves. They call things after a really funny story that happened once and that 400 years later no one knows or remembers. So if you have a frontier concept or a conquered concept, then you can just have things named after anything. And so that gives you a hell of a lot of freedom if you're writing a conqueror, a conquered world. Sometimes they're named after legends. So you get, there's one village in Wiltshire, I think, that's called after a white lady, like after a white lady ghost and things like that. They often named after the local lord. So again, if a conqueror's come in, they might be like, okay, my name is John, so this is called Johntown. It's often arrogance or just because their presence alone has caused a village to spring up, you know, with that whole nucleated settlement thing that a lord has settled somewhere for that to be his castle. A village springs up, so of course he says, ah, I'm going to call it me. This happens as well with abbeys and churches, where the villages sprung up around a central point that originally there was sort of like a church is built in the middle of a dispersed settlement, and then a village then grows around the abbey in turn. In that case, they're frequently named after the abbey or church, so, you know, St. Martin's, St. Asaph, things like that. So you got your village, you've got your name. Let's talk about how those villagers are going to eat. Let's talk on the basic level, hunter-gatherer. So the gatherers, it depends on the area you're in, obviously. In a forest region, gathering food is extremely common, so you have that whole Little Red Riding Hood, Hansel and Gretel kind of thing, where even the children would be going out into the woods and collecting berries and mushrooms and truffles and bringing them back while the adults did more strenuous work. That's also common in arid regions, but anywhere where there are dangerous animals, so if you have dragons in your world, it's going to be armed people going out into the world to gather what food they can. In a war-torn area where it's impossible for farmers to maintain fields, people tend to revert to gathering. During the Hundred Years' War, villagers would sort of eat bark and grass, and that was about it, because that's all that they could gather, because everything had been stripped after, you know, 100 years of war in northern France. Also, anything centralised, like a field or a well, becomes extremely dangerous to visit, because it's a focus site from your enemies. I am going to say very lightly, I'm going to talk about gender roles in a later podcast. It's going to be at least one podcast, maybe more. But they're not as binary as archaeologists from the past would have had you believe. There was a huge bias of patriarchal and male-oriented societies documenting hunter-gatherers as patriarchal and as very binary, even though they weren't, because it was the only way that they could perceive things. So you have like a Victorian chap with five names going into the middle of Africa and assuming that because the women do the gathering and the herding, that they are somehow lesser. It's utter bullshit. For a start, the male-female line down the middle isn't as clear as that. If you're good at fighting, you become a warrior. If you're good at, you know, spotting things, if you've got good eyesight, you're going to go into the hunter-gathering things. If you can hear my cat in the background, I apologise. So don't feel that you have to be tied down to that. There's a huge amount of bullshit and paradigm altering done in the past that is finally being rectified. But if you're going to do a hunter-gatherer thing, have female hunters, have male gatherers, because that's kind of how it actually goes in real life. To move on from quite neatly into, therefore, into hunting, my cat is making a fuss, so I'm going to stop recording and pick up in a second. Where was I? Okay, let's think about the more nomadic and environmentally sustainable model of food gathering, as well as the ones we've discussed. You've got grazing in a more nomadic style, so you'd follow the herd. You know, this is almost like on the very verge of farming becoming a movement, as it were. There's either, you know, you hunt the herds out whilst they move and make sure you never take the pregnant mothers or never completely cull a herd. But also grazing pigs in forest lands and making sure that your sheep don't eat all the grass and then
you know, create dust bowl effects. The hunting side of things, one of the reasons that overhunting and the extinction of many species occurred is because hunting became a thing for the nobility, and it became a sport more than it became a source of, you know, desperately trying to get food. Once that happened, you get the introduction of forest preserves, not for environmental reasons, but so that the lords would always have an area to get the exhilarated and to kill without the filthy peasants getting in the way. You get the forest laws, so somebody couldn't go into a wood with their dog, because then their dog would have its, you know, its toes cut off, so it couldn't hunt anymore, and frequently, of course, die, because no antibiotics. And people would have like ankles and wrists broken and be hung from shackles for trespassing in like the sort of 1100s, 1200s. So it became a huge issue, and one of the reasons that the barons rebelled against King John was actually because he was trying to abolish the forest laws for the sake of the people, and they didn't want it. It's nothing to do with, you know, democracy. It was nothing to do with the hostages that were released. It was far more to do with John trying to take power away from the barons and give it to the people, which they didn't like. Forest laws prevent mean that anybody on that land would be poaching, which is a crime and can be punishable. But it takes it forces productivity away from people hunting. The way that they need food is that they'd have to grow it out of the ground. And the lords who did things like this, who did things like taking command of hunting, were also the ones who would have their own field, and then they'd have little strips of land, and everybody would have their own little strip. But in order to be allowed to have their own little strip, they'd have to work on the lord's land as well. So taking hunting as a privilege away means that people are forced to buckle down and work through the mud. And that's kind of like the transition between serfdom, where anybody would just have a serf to work their patch, to a more feudal state where everybody has to work together in order to serve the lord. Kind of sucks. It's a way of subjugating a people. So again, really, really good for conquered regions in your book. The agricultural revolution happened around the 1700s, and that was actually when fields were invented, kind of thing. It was, I think it was Italy that started it, but I could be wrong. And it slowly trickled through in the 1700s, 1800s into the UK, where people would have closed off herding areas so that animals could be more easily tracked and more easily maintained. And then they had a rotating field system so that the nutrients wouldn't leave the soil, but all the area was still being worked all the year round and throughout history, kind of thing. So the landscape that you see is sort of, especially in the UK, of like these very, very clear squares of fields all over the countryside is a very, very recent development. It's a control of food, but it's associated more with, again, with people starving, because all of the fields were sort of just taken over by the lord. And then again, it was a case of you just worked and you got a portion and a tithe, but you still had to pay taxes out of what you were making. It's something that you accept until you think about it, and then you think, why? who got to say who controlled it? So yeah, very, very good if you're trying to do a conquered area. If you're trying to do a pure freedom, it doesn't make as much sense. It makes a lot more sense for everyone to have their own plot within a garden, within their own walled area, kind of thing, than it does for everyone to work the lord's fields, obviously. This ties kind of neatly into talking about affiliation. Are you paying taxes upwards to a kingdom, into a king's pocket? Do you pay through to a city-state like Genoa or Venice, where you had surrounding farms and villages around a major city in a major trade hub? Are you part of a frontier in the middle of absolutely nowhere that started out anarchic and ended up slightly, you know, run by corrupt people? Because, yeah, people suck. The main focus on this is going to be within, like, protection, road care. If you're in a frontier, the roads around it are going to be absolute shit. If you're in a kingdom, the main roads tend to be really good, you know, up and down, sideways. But all the little tracks tend to be much, much worse. The streets are in a village are really unlikely to be paved with stone. Right in areas where it's the villages are up on stilts, you'll have wooden walkways to get out of the mud, to get out of the swamp. But if you're talking the traditional European model, There were still like packed dirt streets in what is now central London, in like the 1800s. It's described as packed earth. But the care of roads is up to the king in a kingdom. It's up to the city state, but they tend to only give a damn about the main trade routes. The other, of course, main thing is protection, and I'm going to talk about that in a little section called Law and Crime. The reason affiliation has such an impact on the village itself is different affiliations have different criminal systems, they have different legal systems, and different perspectives on what is needed. For a city-state, a huge amount of their protection existed because the surrounding villages are what created the stuff that made the trade possible and made the city great. So the militia would be focused in the city, but they would have patrols, you know, as in the Veliky Novgorod, Tishyashi. Please forgive my Russian. I don't speak Russian, so I've only ever read the word. But their militia would have an out-of-towners department who would be in charge of patrolling. So it really depended where on the patrol route you were. Or you could travel to the city-state and appeal for help for, you know, people, adventurers coming in and smashing all your pots. In the kingdom model, the main focus is on the roads. The main roads between each major city would be protected the most by militia in case of invasion from elsewhere, in case of rebellion, and in case of bandits. The local laws were mainly in charge of getting rid of bandits, and in a similar model to the United States police force at the moment, there's a huge amount of corruption and therefore a huge amount of danger to anybody who wasn't in a privileged position. So, with human nature being what it is, there's always going to be blame pointed around. If somebody is jealous, they will try and make things worse for the person they're jealous of, because people suck. So whether you want to echo this in elves, or whether you want to do the class system, a caste system, anywhere where there is a lord and his militia are in charge of the area, there is going to be corruption and there is going to be bias. From 1195, in addition to the sheriffs that had been introduced to protect people from the lords, coroners were introduced to try and protect people from the sheriffs. And also to add in an extra layer of accountability for criminality. They were introduced by Hubert Walter, amazing guy. Research him if you want, a patrician from Ankh-Morpork, but a good guy kind of character, amazing person. And it was also to fill in between to help with the corruption of the assizes. Basically, every month or every 4 months, what depending on where you lived, a judge would come into the area and all the criminals would be brought forward to answer for their crimes and usually be punished. They would have been languishing in a cell since then, whether they were innocent or guilty. So the coroners were there to try and introduce some kind of trace. They're kind of like detectives, and they'd have four knights that traveled around with them. Why aren't there movies or TV series about that? Seriously. But it was also to back out of the discrimination and the finger pointing. At that point, the hue and cry was actually you were obligated legally as a member of a village that if somebody said thief, thief, you had to go thief, thief, point and chase as well. Like, it was a legal necessity. You could get fined for not taking part in a hue and cry after somebody who'd been accused of being a thief. Not found of being a thief, accused of being a thief. In the same way, if a body was found near the village would be fined if they didn't find out who was the killer and hand them over. So if you killed someone and dragged them to the next village would get fined for your murder. Your killing. So that, I think I'd love to see that in some D&D, just not so much of a quest, but different people in the village who maybe don't even know each other that well having to solve crimes. Come on, give it to me, people. Obviously, they're very, very harsh punishments throughout the medieval era. Harsh punishments usually indicates centralization. This is a really broad strokes, but a centralized, a monarchy, a kingdom, or a government is going to encourage harsh punishments of crimes so that people don't commit the big crimes. So they're not going to rebel because they're too scared of stealing a loaf of bread kind of thing. So a harsh punishment is always connected to a harsh central government. In a more tribal thing, because people are more interconnected and more important, there's less of that brutality, except for like extreme cases. So it's very, very rare to get like the people who were bricked up inside trees in the Druidic era, because it was only reserved for the absolutely unforgivable crimes. I want to draw your attention to something. There's been a story going around recently, but there's a tribe in Africa called the Babemba tribe, what they do when somebody's committed a crime, they put them in the middle of a circle and then they talk to them about all the good things they've done. And a combination of, you know, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do bad things, because look at all the good stuff you've done. Which is an incredible thing, psychologically, of both that emotional guilt of how could you, we're not angry, we're just disappointed. But also of welcoming that person back into the tribe and not shunning them, which is something that tends to happen, again, within harsh rule, because if you say that person has committed a crime, shun them, you are so terrified of being shunned as a social species that you're less likely to commit the crime for that reason. In the same way, you know, if it's about justice, you would never publicize the deaths of criminals. So anything like hanging or public beheadings, the fact that they frequently invite lots of people in to see lethal injections even, it's not so much about anything other than keeping an iron thumb pushing downwards. So consider that within your criminal things, and it flutters out to villages and to the worst of human nature and things like that. But consider alternatives, and consider loyalty within a small community of people who will stonewall and say no, we don't know who it is, and take the fine. It would be a really, really cool thing to do. I just want to, before I go on, to talk a little bit about, again, to link back to the reasons why you're affiliated with a kingdom or a city-state, again, to talk about the trade and the fact that once you've got interconnectivity, you have a lifeline. So you can sell pots if you have a lot of clay in your area, you can sell beads if you have a lot of precious gems in your area, or you know, precious wood. And it's kind of like a step on from the old tribal way of finding something you're good at and doing it. You know, if a village has a resource, they mine it, they grow it, and then they can sell it and become interconnected. It's very rare, except in the frontier model, for a village to be truly isolated. You also get travellers coming through, you get drovers bringing cattle through to the big markets, you get peddlers and tinkers. And if you think about people who are travellers, either, you know, the Rom or Irish travellers, or, I can't remember the name, the Torkic ones, then you have people with specific skills who travel from place to place and can offer that skill to other places. So if you've got your people questing, you know, what are the skills that they're bringing? Is it just that they're good at the sword? Because anybody can be good with the sword. You know, not everyone could be a master, but everyone could be good at the sword. Also, people like bards and chroniclers who would go from place to place telling stories, who would pick up the folk legends from each region that they went through and you know, and almost paddle them on, you know, as a new story in a new place. Okay, last of all, I want to talk about the main features of a village. Again, this is very Western and particularly European-centric. It is really weird to me when I go out to the US and you get these huge residential areas and it's just residential, and they might have a park and they'll have like a fire station, and that's about it. And that is really bizarre to me. Like, it is really strange that you have to drive for half an hour to get to the shops or, you know, whatever. So these are features that would definitely exist. I'm going to start, therefore, with a proviso in that if you have a dry country, obviously this isn't relevant, but if you have alcohol in your country, there will be a pub in every single settlement by about, like, the 1300s, at the very latest. So you've got a pub, you need a gathering place that is separate from the pub, although occasionally they were used as the same thing. You need somewhere for, like a town hall. And occasionally people would just use like a large room in the inn for that, but anything like a town hall or a marketplace, somewhere where people can meet together and say, you know, where are we going to wave our pitchforks? You're going to need either a healer and or a midwife. She can be both, obviously.
Yeah, you would need one of those in the village. There's always going to be a midwife. There would always be a midwife in training at any time because they were so precious. You're going to need a blacksmith who can measure, not measure, who can mend shit, and make shit. You're going to need a bathing space, either a bathhouse, baths available in the inn, or a river. In the early world, by about sort of again by about I want to say 1200, 1300, people might have been able to have wooden tubs of their own. But anywhere where there is any kind of equality or peace and happiness, you're going to have a bathing area. You're going to need either an area for either religion or relaxation. So either a church, a chapel, a shrine, or just a meditation space, depending on what your religions do. You're going to need, this is going to sound bizarre, you're going to have a lover's lane. There's going to be somewhere where the young couples always go to make out, to avoid parents, where their parents went and where they assume that no one knows about, but, the young people. It's going to sound so strange to people not from the UK. But yeah, there's always somewhere where people sneak off to. I assume that's universal. It is not something necessarily that is written in history books, but it is something that you always notice if you're in a village. There's always a place called Lover's Lane, Lover's Hill, things like that. Grope Lane, oh, Grope Lane in York, things like that. You're going to have stupid traditions and stupid folklore. There's a town in Shropshire where they have a duck race. There are pig races. There is swimming in swampy fen infested ditches. There is using rocky river, tiny little river areas in Scotland where they go naked down these rocky water slides, bruising and bashing themselves. But it's just tradition. It's what that place does. A village is always going to be a stupid place. Anywhere where you have people is going to be a little bit stupid. And they will get really, really enthusiastic about it. And that's kind of one of the good sides of humanity, is that they have this thing of like, oh my God, no, you don't understand. The annual cheese rolling is the most important event of the year. I'm going and I need a new ribbon. So don't be afraid to be a bit daft with your villages, because these people live there all the time. Your questers may only be passing through, but they live there all year round. So, cut them some slack. And above all, don't kill the chickens.